WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last month, Francis Ford Coppola, George Lucas, and other filmmakers gathered to honor Walter Murch at a tribute produced by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Murch is a film editor and sound designer who has been nominated for 8 Academy Awards. He won in the categories of sound and editing for The English Patient, which made him the first person to win in both categories for the same film. He also did the sound for Apocalypse Now, The Conversation, The Godfather Trilogy, and The Talented Mr. Ripley. He worked on the restoration of the Orson Welles classic Touch of Evil, which has just been released on DVD and video. He'll talk about the restoration in a few minutes. First, we're going to hear Michael Ondaatje's comments about Murch, recorded last month at the Academy tribute to him. Ondaatje wrote the novel The English Patient.
Driving the curving road into San Francisco, Walter Murch glances down at the speedometer and says, "This car has almost reached the moon." "What?" He says, "The distance to the moon is 238,713 miles. This car has gone 238,127 miles. And most of it has been on this winding road." This is a typical Walter Murch piece of small talk. He's a man whose brain is always peering over the wall into the world of scientific and technical knowledge. The book on his table that he is probably reading is Our Place in the Cosmos by Harlan Wickramasinghe. He's written In the Blink of an Eye, a wonderful book on editing. He has translated the works of Malaparte. He doesn't watch television at all. He doesn't watch too many other movies when he's working on one himself. As a writer, I discovered during my peripheral involvement with The English Patient that when I watched Walter Murch edit, this was the stage in film that was closest to the art of writing. Walter likes to quote the dictum that a film is born 3 times, in the writing of the script, in the shooting, and in the editing. With The English Patient, there were in fact 4 births, and I'd like to chart and show how different and variable these births are in terms of one scene. In the novel of The English Patient, there's a moment when Caravaggio, whose hands are bandaged, watches a dog drink from a bowl of water and remembers how he was tortured 3 years earlier. Something about the table he is sitting at begins this quick flood of memory. The scene is about 2 paragraphs long, and the dog beside him is in the present, and the torture scene is in the past, and they merge. He doesn't want to face that traumatic moment, so it is vaguely, intentionally vaguely remembered. It is dreamlike, not at all realistic. When Anthony Minghella wrote the script, the scene went on for about 4 pages of sharp and frightening dialogue. It was now a scene where the German interrogator, not Italian as in the book, tries to break down the defenses of the court spy, Caravaggio. In order to link Caravaggio more to the crimes of The English Patient, it is clear in Minghella's version that Almazi is the cause of the capture of Caravaggio, which leads to the torture. We are therefore already a long way from the scene in my book. In the novel, the past just haunts them at a certain moment, but none of this torture is described in detail, just suggested. Minghella's scene, brilliantly written, has tense dialogue repeated again and again, with the interrogator casually circling around to catch him by surprise. The next 3rd birth was the shooting of the scene. As Willem Dafoe, who played Caravaggio, said, "We shot the hell out of the scene." And they did, at least 15 takes, and then close-ups, an opening razor, close-ups on the typist recording the interrogation, a fly crawling over Caravaggio's hand that buzzes off as the razor enters a frame. I remember one stunning take where the camera stayed on Defoe's face all through the scene and stayed with him as he pulled the table he was handcuffed to all the way to the back of the room to avoid that razor. When I saw the assembly, this was the moment in the film I thought most remarkable. In any case, Minghella had taken another step forward from the written screenplay with the shooting of the scene. Now he gave it to Murch. And what did Walter do with this scene? Well, he had been reading the Italian writer Malaparte on the Nazi character, and he plucked from his reading the fact that the Nazis hated the showing of weakness. If they witnessed it, they were so appalled they would try to force that weakness out of you by exerting even more cruelty. This idea was certainly not in my book, not in Mengele's script, not in the 25 minutes of footage that had been shot and which had now had to be cut down to a terrifying 3 minutes. Every scene for Walter needs to have a larger science of patterns at work within it. And this was going to be the idea or concept that governed the way he cut the scene. At one point, Caravaggio Defoe says, when he sees the razor, don't cut me. He says it once. Walter has the interrogator pause in his questioning when he hears this, extending the time of the response. He has threatened the spy with the idea of cutting off his thumbs, but only in a casual way, not serious way. When Caravaggio says, don't cut me, the German pauses for a moment. The interrogation continues. At some point, Walter found another take of Defoe's line, this one with more of a quaver in the voice, and he decided to put it in again a few seconds later. So Defoe repeats his fear, his weakness, and now time stops. We see the look on the German, and now we know he has to do what he was previously just theorizing about. To emphasize this, Murch, at this very moment, pulls all the sound out of the scene and plunges the soundtrack into silence. And we, if we don't realize it as we sit in the theater, are shocked for some reason, and it is because of that quietness. Something terrible has been revealed about the spy, about his own nature, and now something terrible is going to happen. Up till now, Walter has built numerous layers of sound to give us the feeling of being within that cave-like room. He even provides sounds taking place outside the room, a favorite device of his. In this scene, there is the sound of firing squads outside, soldiers yelling, typing, flies buzzing, telephones ringing. Then when Defoe repeats that line, which in reality he did not repeat, which was not even there in the script, Murch makes the response to the line a total and dangerous silence. Walter has said that the use of silence in movies did not come in until the invention of synchronous sound in 1927. Till then, there was the continuous accompaniment of music, live orchestra, organ, or piano. As an editor, he always tries to find a moment in his films to have that shock of silence filling the theater. And in this film, it happens now. It feels as if it lasts 5 minutes, but in reality, just about 5 seconds. And during that time, all is decided. And after that moment, all hell breaks loose. This is where members of the audience begin to close their eyes, and where some faint. In fact, they probably faint because they close their eyes, because we see nothing violent on the screen. But we hear the suggestions of it. And the ones with closed eyes are now under the control of this master sound editor, and so they imagine it all.
Michael Ondaatje wrote the novel The English Patient. His comments about sound designer and film editor Walter Murch were recorded at last month's Academy tribute to Murch. Murch was the editor and sound mixer for the restored version of the Orson Welles 1958 film Touch of Evil, which has just been released on DVD and video. The film is generally acknowledged as one of Orson Welles' great achievements, but it was first released as a B-movie and flopped at the box office. The audience never saw exactly what Welles had intended. The studio did the final cut, and that version infuriated Welles. In response, he fired off a 58-page memo explaining his original intentions. The complete memo was tracked down a few years ago by Rick Schmedlin, who used it as the basis to produce the restored version of the film. The restored version follows Welles' intentions as outlined in the memo. Touch of Evil is set in a seedy town on the Mexican border. Charlton Heston plays a Mexican narcotics officer honeymooning with his new bride, played by Janet Leigh. The honeymoon is quickly interrupted by a bomb explosion, which Heston feels compelled to investigate. But he's up against a corrupt American police chief, played by Orson Welles. Murch describes the opening shot as a Rosetta Stone for film students, a shot that is logistically and technically difficult, which is made to look effortless.
The shot is a 3.5 minute long single take, which involves the population of an entire city, a very lively border town at the crossing between the United States and Mexico. And you begin on the Mexican side of the border with a big close-up of a pair of hands putting a bomb in a car, turning the clock to 3 minutes and 20 seconds, which justifiably becomes the entire length of the shot. So he predicts right at the beginning of the shot how long the shot will be, because that's when the bomb will go off. And then the camera cranes way up into the sky and has a overview of this entire street and this almost the entire city, and then drops way down to street level, sees people on the street, and then picks up Charlton Heston and Janet Leigh, who play the leads in the film. And then the car with the bomb in it comes into the shot and leaves the shot, and then there's some other bit of business, and the car comes back. So it's a very complicated shot that ends with a whole dialogue scene, still part of the same shot. And then the dialogue scene ends, the Charlton Heston and Janet Leigh go off, and they have a kiss, and then right when in the middle of their kiss, the bomb goes off. So everything is contained except for that final bomb within this single shot.
Now, in the released version of the movie, this spectacular shot is obscured by the opening credits. And also, Henry Mancini music plays, you know, the opening credit music plays over this entire scene. Now, that's not what Orson Welles wanted. What did he want?
Well, let me just read you from his memo. This is a document that he wrote in a single night. It's about 58 pages long. And he was allowed by the studio to see his film one time only. He had been fired off the film effectively 4 months before the film was finished. And those are four extremely critical months in the life of any film. He saw what they'd done to it. He saw that they had written new scenes, added new dialogue, shot whole new sections of the film. And this is his response. He begins, actually, with talking about this very thing. This is Orson Welles talking now. "I assume that the music now backing the opening sequence of the picture is temporary. In fact, it was not. This was Henry Mancini's title music. Then, as the camera moves through the streets of the Mexican border town, the plan was to feature a succession of different and contrasting Latin American musical numbers. The effect, that is, of our passing one cabaret orchestra after another. In honky-tonk districts on the border, loudspeakers are all over the entrance of every joint, large or small, each blasting out its own tune by way of a come-on or pitch. The special use of contrasting mambo-type rhythm numbers with rock and roll will be developed in some detail at the end of this memo, when I'll take up the details of the beat and also specifics of musical color and instrumentation on a scene-by-scene, transition-by-transition basis." You can get from that paragraph the depth of detail that he was going to go into in this memo. But what we read there was our instructions from Welles about what to do. Once the titles had been eliminated from that opening shot, and we were very lucky to find what's called a textless background, which is just the images without any titles on it. So we found that negative, and we were able to use that to integrate into the rest of the film and have that shot have no titles over it. So now you can see everything that's going on in the shot. The way it was, you had to look around the titles to see what was actually happening in it, which Welles hated.
Now, had Welles recorded all the sound that he wanted to use there? And if so, did you have access to that recording? Or did you have to do the sound from scratch for that opening scene?
Well, that's another interesting thing. We actually found the original sound for that scene. Not the music part, which I had to manufacture by lifting pieces from other places in the film, of music that he had also used in the film. Strip joint music, rock and roll music, mambo, cha-cha music, all coming out of little tinny loudspeakers, which he had recorded. But once the Henry Mancini original title music was on, the studio made the decision to eliminate almost everything of the effects track, the sound track that Welles had also produced. So the sound of people walking, the sound of the crowd, the sound of a group of goats that they come across in the middle of the shot, the car sounds, all of this was really absent. And when you heard the previous version of the film, your memory is of nothing except Henry Mancini's music. So by eliminating Mancini's music, we were also, surprisingly, because we didn't know it was there, we were able to reveal this whole other dimension to the film, which has never been heard before.
Let's hear how that opening scene sounds. We won't hear all 3 minutes of it, but we'll hear some of it and hear that kind of a very varied sense of different cultures in one town that he wanted to establish in this opening.
Okay.
Sound from the film Touch of Evil. We'll talk more with Walter Murch about restoring the film after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Walter Murch. He was the editor and sound mixer for the restored version of Orson Welles' 1958 film Touch of Evil. It's just been released on DVD and video. Now, I believe Orson Welles, in this long memo that he wrote to the studio telling them why they should do the film the way he wanted it cut, he said that the sound in this scene should be as bad as it would have been in real life. I mean, he wanted the sound from these speakers and car radios to be really tinny, like in real life. So that's instructions that you followed.
Yes, absolutely. This was a very revolutionary thing at the time. In 1958, when you made a film and you put music to it, everyone's impulse was to make the music sound as good as possible. This is roughly the equivalent of when you're shooting a scene in a slum. Even though it's a slum, it's not really dirty. There's a whole other aesthetic that says, make it as dirty as possible. And that was what Welles was following in his use of music here. Again, let me just read from his memo. And I should emphasize that this is the only time in the whole memo that he goes into a narrow column with capitals. It's very big. It says, it is very important to note that in the recording of all these numbers, which are supposed to be heard through street loudspeakers, that the effect should be just that, just exactly as bad as that. The music itself should be skillfully played, but it will not be enough in doing the final sound to run this track through an echo chamber. To get the effect we're looking for, it is absolutely vital that this music be played back through a cheap speaker in the alley outside the sound building. Since this is not very expensive, I feel justified in insisting upon this, as the result will really be worth it. Now, right in that, you can get a sense of how mysterious Orson Welles was to the studios, because here he's saying at the beginning of it, it should be as bad as it really is, as bad as possible, and at the end he says the result will really be worth it. And this was a mentality, certainly at Universal in the late 1950s, that people just had a hard time understanding. But it adds to the realism, and since that time, this technique is now universally applied in film. But in 1958, it was completely outside of anyone's experience.
Now, one of the things that the studio changed was Orson Welles' cross-cutting in the movie. There are two main characters, Janet Leigh and Charlton Heston, play an American and a Mexican who have just married. He's a cop. And the story kind of alternates between her point of view and his point of view. He's investigating the murder while she's getting terrorized by the bad guys. And the film cuts back and forth, and I guess the studio found that really confusing.
This happens in the opening reel of the film. And Welles had intended the two stories, that the married couple gets separated quite soon after this explosion. And for the rest of the film, really, we're following their two independent stories, which finally get linked up together during the climax. This was a not a usual technique for any films in 1958, particularly B films. So they felt, at least in the opening reel, let's make it all normal. We'll just play the whole scenes, we'll play them out as they were intended to be as full scenes. This is their interpretation. The trouble with that is that you're grafting on the limb of a tree onto an animal, that the two things just don't mesh. The whole film is about cross-cutting, so if you make the first reel not be about cross-cutting, then you're essentially teaching the audience to understand this film in a different language than the rest of the film will be. So that was probably the main note that Orson had in this entire 58-page memo was restore my cross-cutting. It's essential because each story is equivalent. The man's story is just as important as the woman's story and vice versa. And I want each time we go back and forth for it to be not too long and for each section to be just about the same length. The way it was, you spent 5 or 6 minutes with Charlton Heston. Janet Leigh was long gone by that point. So at the end of 5 minutes, you probably thought you were justified in thinking, yeah, this film is about Charlton Heston. So then when it goes to Janet Leigh and her story, you're thrown for a loop.
Walter Murch, he was the editor and sound mixer for the restored version of Touch of Evil, which has just been released on DVD and video. Our interview was recorded in 1998. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.